Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFPU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we hear about a program developed in conjunction with McMaster University called iEquip, which gives students a chance to apply what they are learning in the classroom in a real-world healthcare environment. We sit down and talk with the director of the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts about their Industrial Fabric Festival of the Arts, now underway, and the exciting future that lies ahead for the art school at Brock. And we chat with the Vice President International for the Graduate Students Association at Brock. Radio that travels the globe to deliver research right here in Niagara, Inquisitive Minds, is on the air. And we welcome you to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM. Once again this week, my voice will be fluctuating from interview to interview due to my recent illness, so don't adjust your radio dial. It really is me. But what's a radio dial? What's that? Never hear about that anymore, do you? On with the show. With the opening of the new hospital facility in West St. Catharines last year, a much improved environment for healthcare in North Niagara had finally arrived. The new facility is an up-to-date, spacious, and state-of-the-art hospital we can be proud of here in Niagara. But the building and its equipment are just that. It takes people to use the equipment within the building in order to provide better health care for the patients who come through the doors. Madeline Law is an associate professor in applied health sciences at Brock, and her research interests are in the area of health administration across the healthcare system. Her research extends into studying team effectiveness, organizational culture and change, and learning from experiences throughout the healthcare system. In conjunction with McMaster University, Madeline has set up a program called iEquip, or Interprofessional Education for Quality Improvement, that gives students the chance to apply what they are learning in the classroom by having them intern in a variety of programs and services in the Niagara Health System. Madeline Law visited our CFPU-FM studios last week, and I asked her how the program works.
So iEquip is the Interprofessional Education for Quality Improvement Program, and what it is a partnership between Brock University, so the Department of Health Sciences, and the Michael G. DeGroote School of Medicine at McMaster, and together with a number of partners in the health system, so the Niagara Health System and Hotel du Shaver Health and Rehabilitation Center and Tabor Manor, we've all come together and working on quality improvement projects. So the health professionals are teamed up with students from MAC and students from Brock, and they identify quality issue in their health setting, and the students work with them to, I don't want to say fix the problem, but try to understand it and try to develop better processes so that they can improve quality. So, for example, one thing would be wait times in the ED. And so we know that if we can streamline people into beds quicker, then we're able to ensure that people aren't waiting as long. And so some of our students are looking at a different way in which to get people into beds admitted in the hospital, so people aren't waiting in the ED quite as long. So the way the program works is that the students come together, they learn together, health system staff and the university students. They come together, learn in three different three-hour workshops, and then they create the project, and then they roll out the project for a year and a half. And they work collaboratively with meetings and doing different types of process maps and trying to really figure out and get to the root cause of the problems and then create interventions to change them.
So in other words, they're getting the theory in the classroom as normal, and then they're putting it into practice in a form of apprenticeship program when they get out into the field.
Yes, exactly. So they learn in some of the other classes that I'm in as well around leadership and change management, and then, yeah, they go out and they identify a problem, they actually make changes.
The interesting aspect about that is they make recommendations based on their classroom work and research into the places where they're interning. I find that interesting because they're offering suggestions to those they're interning with.
Yes.
And that, I'm wondering, first of all, is there any kind of a pushback from those you're interning with? Because that's a different scenario than they're used to.
Yeah, and I think the difference is that it's seen as a team. It isn't just a student going in and saying, I have to do a student project, and here I am, this is what I think you should do. They're actually coming together as a team, and they do team meetings to understand the process. What the students bring to it, I find, is just that different lens of asking the questions of, well, why is it like that? Because sometimes when you've been working in an organization, you're really ingrained in things that are happening. You really don't always question what's happening. The students also bring a really good research evidence-based lens. So they'll look at the literature and say, oh, well, different places have been trying this, or the research is saying this is a best practice, so maybe we should think about that. I don't find that there's a lot of pushback. I think that people are really harnessing the opportunity to work with the students as compared to being like, oh, it's just a student project, it's not important. It's more, okay, how can we really work together to make an improvement?
Yeah, because although these are student recommendations, these students are, in all likelihood, future healthcare workers, professionals themselves.
Exactly, yeah. And again, the students aren't really always making recommendations. They're working with the team to develop the project, so it's the whole team of the health professionals and the students coming up with those recommendations. But it just provides them with such a great opportunity before they become health professionals to understand, what does it look like to improve healthcare systems? And then they become part of that process. They are health professionals.
So there's not this us and them mentality, mindset, two different factions, and they can't come together and coexist.
Yes, exactly. That's the idea, is that they work together and that everybody brings a different skill set, or the students are able to kind of fill a gap. They might do some of the data analysis. You know, it's really hard and time consuming to do that when you're a frontline nurse, right? But you still know that that's really important. So they're able to do some of that other work that people don't have time for as well.
What kind of recommendations are you hearing? Do you get any of the feedback from these students when they come back?
Yeah, so we have a process. We have, my grad students are mentoring the iEquip group. So we have 14 projects and they each have a mentor. And then we have weekly meetings to make sure that everything's on track, all the projects are happening. So we always get the feedback and hear what's going on and keep the students on track. So some of the things the students are looking at are, so individuals with mental health concerns coming into the ED, and once they're admitted, how do we get them referred out to the proper community resources? So that's one thing. When we look at some of the work in long-term care, is there's a new physical form that's been developed to do physicals on people in long-term care. And what they're doing is they actually made the recommendation that it shouldn't just be the physicians doing it, but that the interprofessional team, so nursing, OT, everyone should be involved in providing feedback on that physical. So the students are really, they're really engaged, and they're really look at what else is out there that we could help improve this process. So lots of cool stuff they come up with.
Well, that's important that the recommendations do get implemented. Otherwise, what's the point?
That's right. And with quality, we know that, especially right now, cost is huge, right? We know that we can't continue the way that we're going now. And it's not so much of throwing more money at it. It's looking at our systems and saying, you know, how can we improve the efficiency or the effectiveness of this to have better cost savings? And really, to look at our patients and make sure that the care is patient-centered.
What do the students take back from the internships themselves?
So I'll give you an example from last year. So I had five students working on projects, and one of them from the McMaster Med School, she was an exceptional student, and she really has used her quality improvement experience in the workplace. So she said to me, she goes, you know, when I go in there in my clerkship, I don't just look at the patient, I look at the whole system that they're in, and I try to figure out, how do I improve their care within the bigger system, not just at an individual level. And so that for me was a key thing for her to understand, that it's not just about treating the disease, it's about treating the patient within that whole system. So I think they get a lot in terms of experience and how does that improve what they're going to be as health professionals.
Interesting. Now, everyone agrees we want better healthcare, and that comes with people on the front lines equipped to do the job they do day in and day out. Now, compared to, say, a generation ago, here's your $64,000 question. Are the healthcare professionals we see today better equipped than their predecessors to handle the healthcare issues we face?
I think that we've created very complex systems in which people have to work. So, you know, as a frontline nurse or even as a physician, you have a lot of new evidence that's coming out with research. And so you have to integrate that in. So I think that maybe makes it a little bit more complex. I think we're asking individuals to change their practice to make these improvements and be more efficient and effective because of cost containment issues. So I think that makes it a little bit more complex. But really, when it gets down to it, we're still dealing with similar diseases, with similar infections. And so, yeah, that's a very good question.
I think one of the problems patients have with the healthcare system is they don't feel anyone is listening to their concerns. That's my sense, anyway. Can your research help in that regard? Essentially, patients feel they have more of a voice when it comes to healthcare?
Definitely. And that's one of the projects that I'm looking at right now around patient experience. So a lot of patients will say that, yeah, you know what, I want the best doctors, I want the best technology. But when it gets down to it, they want to be treated with respect, they want to be treated with compassion, and they want people to really see them as a person and not as their disease. And I think sometimes that's difficult when you're really trying to make that person better. It's like giving them the meds, you're doing the great procedures, but when it gets down to it, it's that experience that person has. And some places do it better than others, and I think we can do a great job at that, and we're doing a great job. It's just, how do you really listen to that patient is going to impact their care. Also, research shows too that safety is better when you listen to the patient. So if they're telling you their concerns, they're like, well, you know, I'm feeling this way today, and this is what I'm thinking. Or even if the family is more engaged in that care, it's actually seen to be more effective and safer and provides them with that better experience.
Yeah, let's talk about the safety aspect, because it's paramount that we make the healthcare facilities as safe as possible. So what are we doing right now to make them safer, and what can we do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I think the one thing around engaging the patients more in their own care and having them have a voice in what's happening, because they're seeing their whole environment and seeing all the things that happen around them. So engaging the patient, I think, is one thing. The other piece is providing that culture where we're able to report when we see something that may not be going right, or I might be the nurse and I might say to the physician, you know what, I'm not sure about this, or can you give me some more information? And so having that freedom, what we call in the research psychological safety, to speak up when you have a question as a health professional to your other colleagues, I think is important. Creating that culture where if I do make a mistake, I'm able to report it so that we can learn from that and it doesn't happen again is another key feature to making sure that we're creating a safe environment for the patients to be in.
Now, this is not something necessarily that you and your research can totally address, but I think one area that should be addressed in healthcare overall is we need more staff on the floor at the area healthcare facilities. And I mean, in St. Catharines, for example, we've got this gold standard facility, but we don't appear to have enough staff to properly staff it. That's not something that we can do through programs such as iEquip, I don't think. But that's, to me, one of the basic problems that we have to deal with right now.
I don't know that I would agree as much around the staffing issue. I think, and I remember an individual, big healthcare leader said to me, he said, it's not about throwing more staff at it and throwing more money at it. It's understanding the processes and making those more efficient and also prioritizing what it is that's important. So if we're looking at that and saying, you know, we need more staff, that's just a stopgap measure. You need to look at the whole system and say, well, what's the process of getting the lab results from here to there? And if we can make that process faster, then we don't need another nurse to make it more efficient. However, of course, there's always going to be gaps in certain places of HR, and I don't want to minimize that. But I think if we prioritize a little bit differently and think about efficiencies and effectiveness and making things safer, then that is one of the places we should go in terms of making things quicker and getting better service.
So in other words, not necessarily more staff, but better trained and better prepared staff.
I don't know necessarily better trained, but more efficient systems in which they're working. And then I think that would make more sense.
Okay. Well, for me personally, I've had really great experiences with the healthcare system in Niagara. And I know I'm not alone. You do hear of problems that do develop, and they do tend to be picked up on and magnified as a, here's what's wrong with the healthcare system mentality in the region. But generally speaking, for myself, I find that the system works, and it works very well.
I've had very similar experiences. I know that when I was quite young, I had quite a bad experience. It could have been life-threatening if my condition hadn't been caught within 18 hours, but it was amazing. I had great outcomes. I had a great process of care, and then others don't. And so you always hear one bad for what is that term, right? You hear the one bad, but you don't hear the 13 good things that happen. So it's hard to make judgments around that, but those are the stories you are going to hear. And what we need to do, I think, as a system, and I shouldn't say we, I'm the researcher, but if I was to be looking at a research project, I would think, how can we use those patient stories to really harness and facilitate and push change?
The healthcare providers, that's one of the toughest jobs around. There's no question about that. It's a job I personally would not want to have. And those who do it, they do it very well. And it's been such a tough job. I admire them for being able to do it day in and day out in the long hours. What do you hear from the students coming back from their internships? Optimism, the system is going to be better than we realize?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's really eye-opening because they'll be on a floor and they'll be doing an observation and they'll say, you know what? That nurse didn't sit down for 7 hours. She just ran and ran and ran and she was just all over the place. So I think that's a bit of an eye-opener for them to say, it's exciting and it's fun, but it's really hard work and there's a lot going on. But I also know that they see things in their environment that they say, you know, I think that could be fixed or we could do something about that. So they have that optimism going forward as well.
So how long has iEquip been in operation then?
So iEquip started last year. So I had my first set of students. There was 5 projects last year, or 6 actually. And then this year is the second year, but we changed it up a bit. The first year they only did it for 1 year, but now I've taken third-year students who work on this project for 18 months, so through their third and their fourth year.
Madeline, I appreciate you coming in, especially on such a snowy day as we record this. But it's great news. I'm thrilled by the information that you're gleaning from the students coming back. It can only help to make this system better, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. So it's a great idea, and I wish you all the best of luck with it.
Great. Thank you very much.
And that was Madeline Law, Associate Professor of Applied Health Sciences at Brock, on her program developed in conjunction with McMaster University, known as iEquip. Believe it or not, we are already nearing the end of the academic year at Brock, although it may not feel that way to some of the students these days. There's always lots to do before the year wraps up, but for those involved with the Festival of the Arts known as Industrial Fabric 4, there is even more business to tend to than usual. The 4th Festival of the Arts, showcasing the remarkable talent of students enrolled in the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts at Brock, runs throughout the months of March and April and allows students to bring their in-class, independent, or studio projects to the public before the academic year ends. The events are not just on campus at Brock either. Many of them spill out into the community at large at studios and galleries and several regional venues. With all this activity going on, I invited Derek Knight, director of the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts, to join me in the studio recently to talk about the school and the creativity taking place in so many venues at this time of year.
Yeah, this is the 4th year of our Festival of Arts, and about 4 years or 5 years ago, the executive, the members of the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts got together and decided to sort of think about how we might bring, particularly how we might bring student activities into some sort of forum, and so the notion of a spring festival, I think, grew out of that. And here we are, looking forward to yet another great 6 to 8 weeks of activities.
Now, it's a 2-month festival. I can't imagine many of the students finding the time to participate in it as their academic year winds down, but they do find the time. How do they do it?
I think you've sort of hit it on the head of the nail in the sense that everyone is extremely busy, but I think what really this particular idea represents is a kind of culmination of many events. And so essentially these are, for the most part, in terms at least the student contribution to the festival, which also includes faculty and other professionals, I think this is really the culmination of many of their outcomes. And so it's a sort of natural, if you will, development from the kinds of things that go on, particularly, let's say, in the fall term, and then ultimately into the winter, where projects develop over the period, perhaps over perhaps 6 months or more, and then find fruition. And so I think it's busy, it's rich, and we try to do what we can in terms of attending the great variety of things that are in fact offered.
Yeah, of course, with the students, it's busy for them, but it's busy for the faculty as well at this time of the year. So you can't get to everything, but you try to get to as much as you can.
I think so. I think my position as director of the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts, I think it's one of my credos to try and, if you will, attend as many events as I can. And to be frank, this is really a kind of exhilarating, I think, series of events. And the fact is that they do progress over 6 to 8 weeks. That gives me particularly time to plot and think and to attend the things that I really would like to attend.
Would you say this is a vehicle to show some of the bright lights, if you will, at the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts to a broader audience? It's not just focused on the faculty and the fellow students up at Brock. The whole community can take part and enjoy what's being offered.
Absolutely. I think that's really a very necessary aspect of what we do. It could be said that our students and our faculty really are the sort of public face, if you will, of the university, and that the very nature of the kinds of things that we do, from performance, musical performance, to theatrical performance, to art exhibitions, that these things inherently are really there for and a public audience. And so I think in that sense it's been a kind of revelation about how in fact we may engage the public in ways which I think are innovative and indeed creative.
Okay, now you don't have to go through the whole list of events, but in a nutshell, for people who want to come and we're whetting their appetite, as it were, what have we got? Because we've got some dramatic arts, we've got music, we've got art, for want of a better expression, as I lose my voice. We've got a little bit of everything for this, don't we?
Indeed, we do. And if I were just to give you a sense of some of the highlights, for example, the One Acts Festival, which is sort of a brilliant series of presentations undertaken by our directing students, a series of short plays over the course of 2 days, March 21, March 22. And those are just two highlights of several other possibilities, for example, that involve dramatic arts. With regard to music, I mean, music, for example, is probably our most prolific group, in as much as that over the course of the academic year, they present something in the order of 30 events. And so this is a sort of a combination, if you will, of some of their professional events, for example, the Encore Professional Concert Series, the Viva Voce Choral Series, and indeed the University Wind Ensemble. And in addition to that, every Tuesday at noon, for example, there's a series of recitals given by instrumental students, faculty, and other professionals. And this is part of the so-called RBC Foundation Music at Noon. And then just finishing, perhaps just my own department is the Department of Visual Arts, in towards the end of March and working through into April, there are a two-part exhibition which represents our honors students. And so all those exhibitions are held at Rodman Hall. So that's a sort of a culmination, as I've suggested, of so many different kinds of events, and truly exciting from our point of view.
And as you just mentioned, not all of the events are on campus. You really do manage to reach out into the community with a lot of these events.
I think so. And in fact, as we also, I think, will talk about the fact that the Marilyn I. Walker School will be relocating, for example, downtown in the summer or the spring and or summer of 2015. I mean, I think that's integral, if you will, to embedding our activities very much within the community itself. So I think that really is what I think we think of as part of our mission. And so the affiliation, particularly with, for example, Rodman Hall, has been a very, very good one, especially for not only the Department of Visual Arts, but I think for the university in general, many, many different kinds of events. And so I think that's just one example of our outreach, if you will, into the community.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Rodman Hall, actually, because I know with the Marilyn R. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts moving into the new venue downtown, the thought crossed my mind, well, what becomes then of Rodman Hall? Is that going to continue as a standalone art gallery as part of Brock, or is there going to be some kind of a change in the structuring of that?
Actually, I don't think there's going to be any change other than the fact that what this really does is enhance accessibility. I'm sort of imagining, for example, 198 St. Paul Street, which is a, sort of the nominal name of the new location of our school. But if you imagine the walk, a fairly short walk, I would suggest, from again, that part of St. Paul Street across the New Burgoyne Bridge, let's imagine, and then just down the Mews into Rodman Hall itself. It's probably something in order of a 10 to 12 minute walk. And so we really look forward to that kind of accessibility. I do think that there's a really strong programming that's going on there. And this has really, I think, in a sense, elevated particularly our students and their interest, again, in the opportunities, for example, to listen to and interact with any number of professional artists, particularly in the case of Robin Hall, in the case of visual arts, for example. The honors students, our fourth-year students, in fact, have studios there. And so that will only enhance that kind of relationship, and I think, for not just our fourth-year students, but thinking across the plank, so to speak, of first, second, and third-year students as well.
You must be very impressed by the breadth and variety of talent that you find when you look at what's going on in the Marilyn I. Walker School. You've got so much and such a lot of young, bright talent there. And in the case of this festival, for 2 months, it's all highlighted for the public. But on an ongoing basis for you, you're able to see that all year round.
Yes, I think so. Mike, I think I'm actually very privileged, much like perhaps all of my colleagues, particularly those who are charged with the mission of teaching on a weekly basis. I think that one of the great sort of revelations for me, particularly as someone who began my career at Brock University within the context of teaching visual arts, and then to rise to a position such as the one I currently hold as director, I cannot begin to tell you how extraordinary this opportunity has been for me personally, and to begin to imagine the quality, I think, of our students and the kinds of extraordinary talents that they bring to bear in terms of their performance and their other kinds of activities. And so I think the true, true insight is to see over the course of, in 1 year, let's say, the extraordinary growth of a particular talent. Again, if that's the kind of talent that we see presented on a main stage, for example, and such as one of our main stages, The Twelfth Night, that we presented in the Ford term, or any number of the other performances that I've mentioned or at least alluded to in terms of our Department of Music. And again, the sort of more sort of insular, if you will, talents of our visual artists who again present often in tandem or at least in group shows their works. So yeah, I think one does not have to stray too far to find extraordinary talent. And it's really, to me, tremendously heartening to imagine that those talents are in fact ours, that is to say Brock University's.
Now let's talk a little bit more about the pending relocation of the School of Fine and Performing Arts downtown. Now, you mentioned that it opens. The timeline is basically spring or summer of 2015, which gives you a little bit of leeway. Now, there was a presentation made at council just recently that you've passed the halfway mark. So, basically, we're on track and on budget, which is good to see.
Yes, I think so. I think that's, from the perspective certainly of the university, that is absolutely key to be, as you say, on track and on budget. I have to just remind myself that as we speak today and as we sort of recognize this actually very important benchmark we've just reached in the sense of 50% complete construction, that this is, we're some 5 to 7 years into the project. And so those initial steps of planning and then ultimately accruing funding, for example, from the government, and then moving ahead with a selection process of the architects, and then ultimately, of course, a construction company. This has been an extraordinary sort of process. And from my point of view, and I think speaking really for all my colleagues and perhaps the university in general, it's been a very interesting process, and one which I think speaks to the extraordinary, if you will, vision, let's say, from the president down of our university to imagine the fact that we could build such a center for the fine and performing arts.
Now, when we say move, essentially everything up at Brock involving the School of Fine and Performing Arts will be moving downtown, right? There won't be anything left up at Brock, in theory?
That's a good question. We're sort of working through many, many sorts of logistics, as you can well appreciate. For example, we have something in the order of 500 students, 24 full-time faculty, some 40 part-time faculty, and 10 support staff. I mean, it's a fact that all of us are going to go downtown, and so we will all be, in that sense, working at that particular site. However, there will be elements of our programs that may, in fact, remain on campus. And I'm thinking particularly, for example, of our large first-year lectures, that kind of thing. It's sort of important, I think, to offer those still on the main campus on the Hill. And that seems to me sort of a logical approach to, at least to non-majors, that kind of thing. People, or at least students who wish to take a course, contextual course or something of that sort within the school, but to afford them that opportunity perhaps on campus is a good idea. But really, the bulk of our program, in fact, the vast majority of our programs will, in fact, be relocated. And the great thing about that, of course, is that we have purpose-designed facilities. And that really, I think, is the key to enhancing everything about what we do as teachers and as researchers.
But it means, I suppose, for a lot of these students who are taking other courses on campus who aren't always involved with the School of Fine and Performing Arts, it necessitates them to have to commute back and forth. that's going to be a given fact of life, I suppose.
Absolutely, I think so. I think probably the analogy I might draw here is that we've really become an urban campus mm-hmm. in that sense. I think that actually is a plus to the extent that, you know, I think the university has made a very interesting sort of commitment to locating and relocating certain aspects of its programs, academic programs, within the core, within the fabric of the city itself. I think there are discussions going on between the university and, for example, the city of St. Catharines to try and sort of figure out sort of things like bus schedules, for example, and repositioning particularly one bus stop that will sort of enable students literally to get off a bus and walk down a pathway some 50 meters and then into our building. Mm. So I think we're actually, we have thought about these logistics. And by the time we, in fact, by the time the faculty moved down in May of 2015 and by the time we offer our first classes, I think all those things should be very much in place.
As much as I love the idea of you being downtown, and I really do, I think it's fabulous that this new complex is going to be downtown. I'm just curious if there was ever any thought given to building a new purpose build, or at least adding something to an existing structure in order to keep the Fine and Performing Arts School up on campus at Brock. Was there that discussion at some point that maybe we should keep it up here?
If I think back some 7 or 8 years now when this idea was first proposed, I think in some ways many of us who've been, for example, at the university for 10 or 15 or perhaps in my case 20 odd years, that was probably always our thought, that we might actually be able to build something on campus. But I think that idea in some ways was trumped by actually a rather remarkable thing which happened in the form of an extraordinary gift from Marion Leigh Walker, who gave us $15 million. And so I think what that enabled us to do, in fact, was to think in much broader terms. And also I think this aligns very much with the idea of the university's mission to actually become, you know, if it wasn't already, to become a sort of major player in terms of how we might think about restoring the downtown core. And so the availability, for example, of the Haircloth building, I think, became a reality in some ways. And so I think the kind of force of that thinking, the idea at least that in some ways that this kind of, I think, a reciprocal kind of relationship between the university and indeed the city of St. Catharines was such that I think for all parties, ultimately, we understood that this was probably in the best interest of everything that we imagined and envisioned in terms of, I think, a dynamic, if not versatile downtown core.
It's a harmonic convergence of everything coming together and it all working out so that you can relocate downtown.
Indeed.
And I think the nice thing for the rest of us, as I've said many times in the program, is that performances at the school, ranging from the departments of music and dramatic arts and also the Tuesday Music at Noon series, will be moving downtown too. So if you're working downtown or you're living downtown, you just walk right over to the new facility and you've got something, maybe give you a break from your work day. So, for example, the Music at Noon series, you can spend your lunch hour watching that, or after work, go to an evening performance if there's something going on, because it's all going to be transferring down there. It's all going to be right there for you.
Exactly. I think you've described that very, very well. And so that literally that interface, again, between our facilities, our programming, and indeed, hopefully the public interest and certainly curiosity about the things that we do are, I think, essential, again, to engaging the public, if not the community, in I think, dynamic, if not sort of versatile ways. So I think the prospect of a lunch break and taking in, as you suggested, one of our Tuesday at noon concerts, or for that matter, we also will have, for example, in our gallery, at our main entrance, to wander over and just sort of stroll in and take in examples of our, not just examples of student work, but other professional work, if you will, let alone, let's say, plays and or recitals, lectures, symposia. I mean, all these things will be there, really, but not just students, but indeed for the public at large.
Now, we talked about the logistics of the move. Is that still ongoing, or are all the plans in place for the move? And now it's just a case of we wait till it's ready and everything mobilizes and we go on and we move down there.
Actually, it's been very, very well organized to the extent that there are any number of sort of subcommittees. There's something called the POC, which is the Project Oversight Committee, which is basically made up from a whole series of people within the university, from sort of senior administrators down through to faculty, staff, and others. And so this particular group meets on a regular basis and actually meets also in tandem with, for example, the consulting architect architects Diamond and Schmidt, as well as PRISM, the project manager, and indeed also the construction company Bird. These meetings facilitate any number of concerns or issues that may come up, and one of the key discussions every time we meet really is to sort of look at schedule and make sure that we're on schedule and that we're dealing again with the kinds of things that you've just described or referred to, the notion of logistics. I mean, for example, one thing that after all the design is said and done, so to speak, one thing we're just about to think about now are the issue of sort of furniture and equipment. We're down to sort of what I might define as sort of the nitty-gritty now. How many chairs or how many tables, or perhaps more importantly, what is the nature of the equipment, you know, we need to bring with us? What is the nature of the equipment we need to purchase? So for us, that's actually something very tangible. It's suggesting that the notion again of thinking it's next year as opposed to 3 years or 5 years from now. And so logistics are indeed important, and I think those are very much in hand.
Now, are there contingency plans in place should you experience a delay? I mean, if the students are expected to be there in the fall of 2015, say you're a month or two behind schedule, what do you do?
Yeah, that's a good question. Fraught with all kinds of frustrations, obviously. I'd like to say that we have every confidence, in fact, in the schedule that's been developed here, especially the construction schedule. The good thing, I think, about that schedule is that substantial completion, as we call it, which is to say a building without doorknobs and perhaps without certain things, you know, walls painted, substantial completion, in fact, is scheduled for sometime in February. So in other words, really several months, let's say, in advance of the fall term. And so there is a certain amount of, let's call it, wiggle room. So I think in that regard, we're very confident that indeed that we'll meet these obligations for the fall of 2015.
So in other words, although the staff may see some incomplete aspects to the building when they get there ahead of the students, for all intents and purposes, when the students get there in the fall of 2015, it should be pretty much ready to go.
I think exactly. I mean, we are actually scheduled to move downtown, as I mentioned previously. I believe it's the third week of May. So I think there's every sort of expectation that even those doorknobs and even those unpainted walls, in fact, should be done by then. But there's still a little bit of room there to, you know, ensure that the facility is up and running. I mean, the key challenge always, given the nature of our facilities, is to fine-tune them, particularly when you start to think about the main stage, for example, the stage house of the theater, that a theater will take time to tune. And, for example, in the case of our digital labs, those will all, again, require tuning. And the best sort of, I think, delivery of those systems is really to have them tested by students and have them actually up and running and working together.
So on behalf of all the staff, are you really looking forward to this move, or are you some maybe dreading the big move?
That's a leading question.
I know it is.
No, I'm not dreading the move at all. In fact, I think there's a real sense of expectation. And for example, I was down at our site in December, and walking through the site and having the opportunity to look at the progress of the construction, simply all that did was simply just steal my enthusiasm. And I think anyone that I speak to who goes into that particular facility, remember it's 95,000 square feet mm-hmm. of purpose designed teaching and other kinds of spaces. And that's actually an extraordinary addition to our general sort of, let's call them, facilities in terms of the university. But I think for those of us within the Maryland Light Walker School, it represents an extraordinary opportunity, because clearly you could say something to the effect that new facilities provide us with new opportunities, in fact, unprecedented opportunities in terms of, I think, our experience at the university. And I think it can only really begin to build and enhance what the reputation that we already enjoy. So my answer simply is I'm enthused by the prospect of our move.
Enthused is a good word. Okay, can you imagine a more exciting time to be director of the Maryland I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts, given what's coming down the pike in a little over a year from now?
I cannot imagine, frankly, a more exciting time. I'm sort of a bit long in the tooth. I've been teaching now for some 20-plus years, and I think it's fair to suggest that opportunities like this rarely come by any of our ways, in the sense of when we think about professionally. This is really the zenith of all of us, really, all of our sort of professional aspirations to be able to, in fact, the architects, for example, have suggested they've never had such kind of in-depth evaluation and analysis of what perhaps our needs might be. And so that long purposeful, determined conversation, I think, is the thing that ultimately will reap all of us this wonderful, wonderful reward. And from my own personal point of view, I can't imagine spending, obviously, the many, perhaps thousands of hours along just with many of my colleagues thinking about this project. And the great reward, well, of course, will be when we step in collectively and the building itself is open. And then we can celebrate that fact, we hope, with invitations, open houses, all of that kind of thing. And so, yes, extraordinary an opportunity and a rare one at that.
Well, good luck with the move. It's an exciting time for the Maryland I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts. I suspect by the summer of 2016, you might be looking forward to a bit of a vacation. Not so much in 2015, but 2016 maybe. Anyway, Derek, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Mike.
And that was Derek Knight, director of the Maryland I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts at Brock, which, of course, will be moving into their new downtown home in a little over a year's time. Right now, they're celebrating their fourth annual Festival of the Arts known as Industrial Fabric. Brock, like many Canadian universities, has a fairly large international student population. Currently, international students comprise one-third of the almost 1,700 graduate students at Brock. In January this year, the federal government announced a new strategy to significantly increase the number of international students studying in Canada. So it is fortuitous our next guest took over the position of Vice President International for the Graduate Students Association, or GSA, in January. Michael Wu, a student in the Masters of Education program, brings to his job experience attending the University of Monash in Melbourne, Australia, back in 2008 to complete his teaching degree. I asked Michael about his experiences in Melbourne and what brought him to Brock University.
I think I really wanted to have experience living in a metropolitan city. At the same time, I think a lot of my friends from Canada really gravitated towards the coastal schools when going over to Australia. So I didn't necessarily want to attend a school that was perhaps saturated with North American students. It would really defeat the purpose as to why I was going overseas.
Now, it's a bit of a circuitous route, Brock.
Yes.
And Melbourne. And what was the university in Melbourne where you were?
I went to Monash University. So that was located a bit outside the central business district area of Melbourne.
So why there to here? Like, what brought you back to Canada and to Brock?
I think the main reason was I think I really want to be building my roots here in North America and perhaps in Ontario. And although the experience in Australia was great, I really wanted to take what I learned there, the experiences I had, and be able to bring that back to Ontario and to see if I could utilize it in my practice professionally and, of course, within the academic field.
Looking at the fact that you attended university in two hemispheres,
yes,
can you draw any parallels between the two or any real differences that you were able to see in university life between, for example, a Brock and in Australia? Or is university, university, university?
I'd say for the most part, the university experiences is relatively similar in the fashion where you have a good mix of domestic and international students. The difference was, I guess, there I was on the opposite side of the spectrum, being the international student. I was surprised that 1 week into my studies, we had a week off. Australia is apparently the country where they have the most holidays in the world. So although we study intensively, there's a lot of time in between. And that, I noticed, was a big difference. As far as the curriculum is concerned, they really, I guess, addressed issues from a different perspective, if you will. So they really drew in a lot of studies from East Asia and the Pacific, as opposed to, I guess, here where I'm doing my studies now, our priority or our main focus is more on North American educational studies.
What was the percentage of international students at the university in Australia you were at? Did you have any number to compare, for example, what we have here at Brock with international students?
To be honest, I wasn't necessarily very involved with, I guess, student politics or student life while I was at the university outside of, I guess, my program and the colleagues that I built there. So as for percentage, I would just have to base it on what it physically looked like. And there was quite a large population of students in Monash where I attended, most of them coming from Southeast Asia and a lot of countries that aren't so prevalent, I'd say, in schools here. So countries like Laos, Malaysia, China, South Korea, Vietnam, again, countries that are a bit more sporadic with the international community here.
Now, you were an international student yourself when you were in Australia, as you mentioned. How difficult is it to adjust to a new culture and a mindset when you're the international student in a new country?
I think that's part of one of the biggest barriers that you're faced with once you go to a different country, albeit a native language in Australia is English. They really also had different perspectives as to what was culturally accepted, and the cultural norms there and practices and way of life was something that I really did have to adjust to. And I think for me, it was something that took a while for me to eventually adjust to. And a major part of it, I think, was having to build those connections. Once you're there, I think many times you could really feel isolated, almost alone, because you're navigating through a university, you're navigating through cities with minimal assistance, if you will. And it's until you build those connections, or if you go through programs that really provide you with that assistance. And I find that's when your experience starts to change.
The fact they speak English would really help. A different form of English, mind you.
Yes.
But yeah, that would definitely help, because if it's in a language that you're not familiar with, that's just going to make you feel so much more isolated. And that's just one more mountain for you to surmount as you're adjusting to this new environment in the university setting.
Yes, no, and I think that's probably one of the main barriers I've found with a lot of international students within the Brock community. I had an opportunity to take an ISP course this summer, so it's an international student program through the Masters of Education. And they offered a class where it was an integration of domestic and international students. And I just found the experience so rich. Although these students are speaking English as a second language, the ability and opportunity to really engage with domestic students really was rich for both sides, if you will. Rich for domestic students because we get this alternate perspective. We get to learn from a view that's different from our own, and that's very enriching in itself. And I think on the other side, for the international students, they too get a chance to really stretch what's, I guess, comfortable for them and what is familiar, and to be open to ideas from a different perspective and culture as well. So I think it's a process of collaboration, something that's really important, and that's something universities really have to start offering their international students.
So as Vice President International for GSA, what do you see your role as being regarding the transition?
I think for the most part, my role is to be an advocate. So it's to really find out what the issues are that international students at the graduate level face, whether it's issues with language, issues with their program, or outside of that. It's really sitting down and being an active part of it. I know that one of the major focuses of this term for me was to really create a committee, a subcommittee, which I have, that's really active in going out there and trying to gauge what the international community needs, what the international community is concerned about, and to take the steps, at least within the purview of this position, to see what we can do to address these issues.
Is there a period of adjustment or any form of adjustment that's needed for the domestic students, as well as you're integrating the international and the domestic students within the university environment? Is that something you have to deal with as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think the time of adjustment is definitely reciprocal. It goes both ways. As much as the international students need time to adjust, if you haven't been drawn or exposed to different perspectives or cultures, it also takes some time for you to acclimate to it as well. Because cultures are different, I think a lot of times misunderstandings happen. And it's only by engaging with it and working through these issues collectively that we're able to adjust.
And you're able to see it on both sides, of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Because you've been an international student, you've been a domestic student.
Yes.
As well. So you're able to address this from both sides then?
Yes.
Does there essentially end up being a sort of cross-pollination of sorts between domestic and international students when they are in that environment together?
I think when they're provided with an opportunity to engage, I'm always very excited to see what happens. There's a lot of potential there, but I think with how the university is set up at present, there is a lot of fragments, if you will. We're all separated into our own silos, whether it's by program or international domestic students. That separation still is there. there, a lot of our shared spaces are designated for either domestic students or international students. And so I think this is a physical barrier that perhaps we could look at changing, if you will, or we could even look at potentially altering so that these spaces are more inclusive. I was very excited about our latest GSA event, though. We held a speed networking event, and for the first time we had an event which was really integrated. We had a really strong mix of domestic and international students. And when these opportunities are present, I think domestic and international students are more than willing to engage with each other. And I think that's something that with this term, I really want to push forward, creating opportunities for us to allow this cross-pollination, if you will.
So basically, with a gigantic networking opportunity like that, it just makes it that much easier for them all to get to know each other in much shorter period of time than in the far-flung reaches of the university itself.
Yes, and I think socially, sometimes it can be maybe difficult to approach strangers within a classroom or within the community as it is. And although Brock, I would say, has a very friendly, engaging, and open community, sometimes a social barrier is something that we have to consider. But I think when we really are proactive about creating these opportunities for students from every program, from every cultural background to integrate with each other, students and the Brock community surprises us and usually is open to the challenge more often than not. I think it's just our role to create those opportunities.
So how long do you hold the position of Vice President International for GSA?
I started this position in January and I'll be holding the position for the term. So although the position should be ending in April, I will still be here engaging in my studies. So me and the subcommittee that I'm running right now fully intend to continue being proactive members of the community and to really create these opportunities for students to integrate, to create really a unified community. I think building community is something that's really important, whether it's the community within the university or even into the St. Catharines community. I think it's something that can enrich the lives of the community as well as the students. And it's something that we're really pushing very hard for.
So are you still active in the summer months then?
Yes, I'm still active in the summer months.
Okay.
I'll be working on my project then.
So what happens in the fall?
In the fall, I guess someone else takes over the position. And hopefully with what we've built and what we leave for them, it's something that we really hope the next group who comes in carries this work on. And I think the major thing is to leave goals that are big, if you will, that are idealistic and that perhaps cannot be attained during our time here, but so that it's something that is continuous and a process that we're collectively always working towards.
Can you speak at all about the federal government's strategy announced in January? What are they proposing, basically?
I know the numbers are increasing, but as far as bringing in more international students, one of my main concerns, and it's something that has been a concern for a while, is how do we improve our relations with abroad, if you will? So it's great to bring in more international students, but what are we doing to make sure these qualifications are transferable? I know that a major concern of mine and a lot of my colleagues studying abroad is, what if our degrees aren't transferable? What if they aren't applicable? What if there's a long process we have to go through to ensure that we receive our qualifications? And I think that's something that with this new federal government implementation plan, it's something that really has to be considered. Otherwise, we're bringing in large numbers, but we don't necessarily have a practical plan to ensure that what we're offering is transferable at the international level.
Yeah, for them, obviously, transferable is key. Yeah. There's no point coming here and taking a course if it isn't recognized somewhere else where they likely will end up being.
Yes.
So you almost expect them to all be interchangeable.
Yes.
But that's not necessarily the case, though, is it?
No, I'd say, at least from my experience, although my qualifications in Australia were transferable, the process and time duration was lengthy and was difficult at times because, again, you would expect perhaps with stronger relations, these processes could be more quick. And in this way, it would be beneficial to the students who go abroad to make these international experiences more welcome and more accessible if the process of transferring was more efficient, if you will.
Now, are you studying at Brock currently?
Yes, I'm a full-time student at Brock. I'm in the Faculty of Education.
Okay.
And I'm completing my Master's of Education at present.
Oh, wow. So how long will that take you?
My anticipated complete date would be August, but it's really based on, I guess, how long it takes me to complete my program. I'm in no rush, but at the same time, I'd like to complete complete my program as efficiently and in a timely manner. My main goal here is to get the most out of this experience. And with this position, with studying full-time, it's been very rich so far, and I anticipate it will continue to be this type of experience moving forward.
So what do you plan to do once your days at Brock are done? Presumably teaching?
I taught in the field for several years, so I actually came back with my teaching degree and went directly into the teaching field. And so after teaching for about, I think, 3 to 4 years, I decided to return to school. So I'm not sure what lies in the future. I would perhaps like to get into the field of development, perhaps into cultural, provincial, or even municipal planning. But I think I'm leaving the door open. I'm happy with the program that allows me to pursue something I'm really interested in. And I'm open, if you will, to see what lies ahead. And I'm not limiting myself to only the field of teaching.
So assuming you do finish your full-time studies in August, as you anticipate, the fact that you may not have something immediately to go to afterwards is not a concern for you. Something will happen.
I think one of the ways I've been living life, and I'd say it's a major part of traveling, is to be open to taking risks and to be open to adventure and a career path that may not be linear, and to have faith in the ability to adjust to new situations. So the teaching profession as it is, if I'd say you're looking for security and if you're looking for a definitive path, then perhaps teaching isn't the profession to go into right now, because I'd say that we are at present saturated with teachers. So for me, at least, I'm excited about the future, and I'm excited about the possibilities that lie ahead, regardless of whether or not I know where they lie at this moment.
Leaving your options open.
Yes, absolutely.
Since you were an international student yourself at one point, was there a sort of international stature for Brock, did you find? Since you were in an entirely different country, in another hemisphere, was there a knowledge of Brock when you were down there?
Well, one of the main reasons I went to Brock was because of their renowned education program. When I studied abroad and when I was doing my teacher education, a lot of students, domestic students and international students, know of Brock. Brock has a very strong reputation in terms of its education program, and I was very pleased to see that it also translated to the international level. And so I'd say, yes, there was a knowledge of Brock, and it was something that I was pleased to hear about.
Absolutely. Now, just out of curiosity, what's your favorite memory of your time in Australia? Because it is a different lifestyle down there.
Yes. I'd say it's so hard to narrow it down, but it's definitely the connections, the experiences with the friends I made. I really went down there with an open mind, looking to gain experience and to gain academic knowledge in a field that is really flourishing, I'd say, globally. And so my favorite experience would be, I guess, meeting people from different countries, experiencing a different culture, enjoying tea time, learning the new, I guess, forms of colloquialism that they use there. The experience as a whole, something that I think I will really carry and remember forever.
Michael, we thank you very much for your time today, and best of luck with your endeavors as the Vice President International for GSA. And whatever comes beyond August, I wish you all the best of luck with it. I'm sure you're going to land on your feet wherever you end up.
Thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate you having me, and thank you for all the support.
There we heard from Michael Wu, Vice President International for the Graduate Students Association at Brock. Michael is a student in the Masters of Education program. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. ¶¶